Good morning, may I be seated? The first case on our calendar is 99-1570, Stephen Simmer et al. Versus Mohammed Davis, M.D. Mr. Clintonitis.
Negligence case, it's not wrongful pregnancy, wrongful life, or wrongful birth.
It's a wrongful pregnancy case, Your Honor, arising from medical negligence.
Okay, but the medical negligence, it's not necessary to have a wrongful pregnancy or any of the other two categories if you have a medical negligence case, is it?
I would agree with that.
The cause of action is really for medical negligence.
Yes.
And that's a distinction that I wanted to understand before you went further, because I think that's the one you're making in your brief, that the medical negligence is the genesis of everything that happens thereafter.
That's correct.
Okay.
This court has already recognized as not being against public policy a wrongful pregnancy case. I believe when the court decided Johnson that you dealt with, in that case, a healthy child as a result of a tubal ligation.
Right, and that was just medical negligence, too.
It was.
Right.
In that particular case, that case is to be distinguished from the case at hand. We take no issue, and we believe that you can follow Johnson and still find in favor of the appellants in this case, with the distinction being that this child, in the similar case, is an abnormal child. The question then becomes one of what is the cause, if you will, applying basic tort principles for the abnormality in this particular child. And I submit to you respectfully that it is not an issue that, if you will, must be related to the precise act of negligence, the fertilization of the egg in this particular case was caused by the failed sterilization procedure. But for the failed sterilization procedure, we would have a defective egg or defective sperm. Because of the failed fertilization procedure, because of the admitted act of negligence of the defendant, this egg was fertilized. But for the negligence of the doctor, this egg is not fertilized. So, the causation in this case comes as a result of the doctor's negligence. If that's true, and I believe that that's the time-honored principle that we must follow here in terms of proximate cause, then we turn to the issue of damages. And I believe, because this is a tort case, that all damages that naturally flow from the negligent act of the wrongdoer must be compensated for. Let's not forget in this case who the negligent party is, if you will, and let's not forget who the victim is. The negligent party is Dr. Doppus, the appellee. The injured party is the appellant, the Simmer. Their injury is an enormous economic burden of $547,000 that was the very concern that they had when they made the deliberate and conscious decision not to expand their family.
Under the statement you just made, then, you would seek recovery for even a healthy child.
No, I would not seek recovery for the birth of a healthy child. No, that is...
But you said all the burdens of expenses resulting from the fertilization raising a healthy child, the expenses that result from health. I don't see how, I don't see where your distinction is.
My distinction is that I believe that Johnson applies. Life itself is a gift. Life itself is not damaged. And I agree with that. So the damages that I am saying apply here, and we have already, as you know from the brief, we have been compensated for the cost of the pregnancy. We are not making it, let me make it clear, we are not making a claim for wrongful life in this case. And if I misspoke, I apologize. We are not making a claim for wrongful life because we agree with the public policy set forth in this particular court that life is, in fact, something to be cherished, and even a life, if you will, that is damaged, nonetheless, it should be cherished.
In this case, the youngster died.
We did not amend our complaint, asking for relief for his wrongful death, for the very reason we are not here making a claim for wrongful life.
The concepts are very interesting, that when you put that to the test, then when will we distinguish between the Johnson, quote, policy decision that one should not be compensated for a life, that life is a gift. And now here you have a child that died, but presumably there'd be claims for children who live with defects. And this child did live with defects for a while. So wouldn't we be faced with at what level of defectiveness is the child then a proper claim? You know, is a child mildly retarded a problem, or a child who's severely retarded different? You know, I wonder if that isn't, if you're really challenging that concept when you try to distinguish Johnson.
If I may, Justice Cook, the issue being whether or not we're going to make a distinction between what is normal and what is abnormal.
Right.
And I think that we should do what we have done in basic tort law, leave that issue to the jury. Whether an injury is permanent or not permanent, we leave that issue to the jury to decide.
Well, that doesn't really answer it, I don't think, because it seems to me when we make a legal distinction, as we have done in Johnson, saying a healthy child is not compensable, then the reciprocal is an unhealthy. I mean, your claim then is an unhealthy child is a compensable sort of injury. So we will have to distinguish the two, and as a legal matter, because it is a legal matter. It's an issue of law about what's a proper claim. Juries can't sort that out. That really will have to be a decision.
I do not believe
as a matter of law.
This court can say as a matter of law what is healthy and what is unhealthy, what is normal and what is abnormal. I do not see any problem in allowing that issue within the constraints and safeguards of motions for a summary judgment, motions for a directed verdict, and judgment notwithstanding the verdict. We ought to trust this issue as we trust other issues that are not finally...
Well, at least we have to define the issue. We'd have to define the legal issue. Is it a legal issue? I mean, juries will sort out as a factual issues and maybe gradations, but they'd have to have a standard. The law has to have a standard to apply. So I'm wondering about the standard that we would apply and give juries as an instruction.
And I guess that's my point, Justice Cook, is that I think we must fashion a jury instruction that is consistent with the definition, whether we look at Webster's, whether we look at Black's, whatever the source may be, whether we allow medical testimony. We do this every day across the state. There are subjective judgments that are made. These are fine judgments. I do not believe that as a matter of law that anybody, this august body of judges, or any other body of judges can make that distinction. It is something that is left within the ordinary common experience of everyday people. This is what juries do day in and day out. If we want to take away that right and have a predetermined position that we want to make, it would be very easy to accept the argument that we cannot make the distinction between normal and abnormal. But I don't think think that's the issue. That begs the issue, because every day, to repeat myself, we do not have precision. That is the majesty, if you will, of court law. This case really goes back to trespass on the case, if you will.
Would you agree that if the child had survived, and that if the damages that you're alleging, the $575,000, actual compensatory damages were paid, would there, because the child is unhealthy, be a requirement of support until the age of 18 or post 18? I was very careful in that Johnson case.
You were very careful in that Johnson.
You look at it, you'll notice that the syllabus is drawn specifically designating a healthy child, because we knew this case was someplace. I just anticipated this was going to happen at some point. Now, the question there was, do you get $300,000 for the support of the child to the age of majority? Are you saying that if this child had lived, all you are asking for is the medical expenses, you wouldn't have asked for support for the child?
Yes, and I think that I support that further by saying that we did not amend our complaint for wrongful life. Because, as I said at the outset, we can find in favor of the appellants here and still follow the mandates of Johnson, because of the reasons that you stated in Johnson. A well child is not deemed to be an injury to the parents. We agree with that. And the fact of the matter is, there are some people, and this is why Justice Cook, that this matter should be left to the jury. There are some people, because of their personal beliefs, who may take even a damaged child and say that this is a challenge to us. We are better people. We are better morally, religiously. We are better Christians. And in that case, a jury ought to consider that. And it would.
Okay, if we're just accepting the fact, because I think we're narrowing down on the issue now, accepting the fact that we're talking about the medical negligence producing compensatory damage by way of medical expenses. Doesn't that, ergo, strike your claim for emotional distress?
I was thinking about that last night, Your Honor.
I'll bet.
And the simple answer would be yes, it does. But with all due respect, I'm going to say that we're going to press that claim forward because of the right, the deliberate right, the thoughtful and considerate judgment that this couple made to restrict their family, and the emotional habit that it wreaked upon them to provide not only the economic support and care that this child desired, but to the rest of the family, the other two children, and anything that is incident to that stress of whether or not there would be enough to take care of this child's medical needs. So the medical needs produce stress to them, and I don't think that we could actually separate them.
Doesn't that then branch off into a wrongful pregnancy?
And we've been paid for that, Your Honor.
And maybe a wrongful birth? If you've been paid for the wrongful pregnancy and emotional distress is a product of that, then the claim is not well taken, is it?
For emotional distress.
If it is a product of wrongful pregnancy for which you've been compensated. You see, that's the problem you get into when you get back in your office late at night and you're writing this and you're thinking each step of the way. So you really have to have here also a wrongful life.
That's a good question. And you know, wrongful life as you defined it in Johnson, says that a physician has a duty to inform the couple that there is something wrong here and they would be given it's a lost opportunity, if you will, to make an election whether there should be an abortion or not. So maybe there is a hybrid between the two, but I don't want to confuse the issue by a label.
Mm-hmm. Don't you have a problem with proximate cause? Or?
Justice Sweeney, I don't believe we have a proximate cause at all with a problem with proximate cause at all in this case, because it is the birth of the child and not the child's defect that must be the proximate cause that is related to the physician's negligence. Let me give you an example.
But the negligence of the physician did not cause the defect.
I agree, and I certainly will concede to that point. Nonetheless, if I run into you and you are a hemophiliac and you bleed to death because you were cut as a result of my negligence, did I cause your hemophilia? No, I did not.
But that you're talking about a pre-existing condition that was prevalent in the patient before he went to see the doctor. The doctor didn't cause the hemophilia. The patient already had it. Here the doctor, because he failed in the tubal ligation, he I can see where you can argue he caused the pregnancy, but did he cause the condition that was present in the pregnancy?
Well, this is what
that's a problem I have with this case, the proximate cause.
Let me just talk about that, if I may, for a minute. We have the but-for test. We have foreseeability, that we know there are a number of instances where, obviously, for proximate cause to be met, we don't have to define the precise injury. We know that from Mudridge and the line of those cases. We know that if, and bear with me, an unfertilized egg and sperm never come together but for the failed tubal. How did the harm occur? The harm occurred.
So you argue that no matter what the deformity may be, that because of the tubal ligation that caused the connecting between the two was the proximate cause of anything that happened thereafter.
Absolutely, because let's look at the converse. If the tubal was successfully performed, conception never takes place. The egg is not fertilized, the genetic defect doesn't materialize, we don't have a damaged child.
Okay. I'm sorry, Chief.
No. Why are we not backed into the question of wrongful birth?
I'm sorry.
It's wrongful birth, it's a wrongful life, isn't it? It makes it a wrongful life case, does it not?
No, it isn't a wrongful life case because we're not seeking damages for the life of the child.
But his negligence caused a life to occur that would not have occurred but for his negligence.
That's right. And I am not asking for a claim for wrongful life. I agree that life is a gift. No matter what its condition, it is a gift.
But the damages flow from the fact that I understand you're not labeling it that, but the damages flow from the fact that there was life.
If we're asking, if we want, we can put whatever label we want on it, Chief Justice. But the damages that flow from a wrongful pregnancy or a wrongful death case, I'm sorry, a wrongful life case, are different than the damages of a wrongful pregnancy, if you will, or a wrongful birth case. The damages are limited. We are not asking for damages for the life. As I said, we did not amend our complaint for wrongful death. We are not asking for laws of society, companionship, mental anguish. All the items under 21 of 502, we're not asking for those damages. So we could say that maybe that's what I'm talking about, but that's not what I'm talking about, because the measure of damages, the state legislature has told us what the measure of damages are for wrongful death. This court has told us what the measure of damages are for wrongful pregnancy. We have settled that part of the claim. And I believe that in Johnson, the only issue in Johnson was not causation, it was damages, what the measure of damages would be.
Thank you, sir. You've used your time.
That's right.
Thank you.
Mr. O'Neill.
That's right. That's what it was.
Good morning, Your Honors. I am Mark O'Neill, and I represent Dr. Dallas. I find the comments of my friend confusing and not helpful. They do not define a standard. They do not define something that would assist a trial court in charging a jury in a case like this. Why don't we somehow distinguish Johnson away and forget about all the case law that's because Dr. Dabas heard the hysterical procedure and the baby was born, let's impose liability on him for what happened. Why don't we do that? Well, we should not do that. We should not do that. Because we impress liability on people who proximately cause injuries. And Dr. Dabas only caused Mrs. Simmerer to become pregnant. For that, he has paid. He did not cause the heart defect. It is conceded that he did not. Therefore, the liability for the cost of trying to remedy that defect should not be impressed on him.
Why should not all of the things that flow from the original negligence be compensable? Now let me just give you an example that I've been thinking about. No, they really aren't. They are for the wrongful pregnancy or for the medical negligence under Johnson. But let me give you an example. If three cars are on the expressway, car one runs into the back of car two, pushing it into car three. Is car one responsible for the damages and injuries in car three? Car one never hit three, though. Isn't there a break in the causal relationship? Pardon me?
It caused two to hit three.
Uh-huh. And didn't this medical negligence cause a birth that was otherwise not desired?
It caused the lady to become pregnant, and it was foreseeable that birth might very well occur. He did not cause the birth. The birth was caused by a family decision to run to full term.
Oh, now you're placing a mother in the position of either, it's one of the things I wrestled with in Johnson when I was doing it. To have anybody suggest that you can say to a prospective mother, oh, you could have had an abortion or you can arrange to have the child adopted and therefore you're not entitled to anything, is to me,
I'm not talking
height and incredulity.
Defenses, Your Honor. I'm not talking legal defenses. I'm trying to parse out this causation issue.
Yeah, and that's what we're all struggling with. At least I'm struggling with the causation issue because there seems to be a break in the chain. But the break in the chain, maybe what I'm doing is saying the chain at the end is the actual birth, when in fact it's the conception.
Well, we start with the operation. And the operation is unsuccessful. It is a mistake. He makes an error. And the lady becomes pregnant as a result.
Mm-hmm.
She then gives birth to a child who is unfortunately flawed congenitally with an abnormality that occurs maybe once out of 2,000 births.
So from that, where is the break in the chain of the doctor's negligence?
The break in the chain, Your Honor, comes from the fact that a congenital defect is not reasonably foreseeable. All of the courts, except one from Rhode Island, all of the courts that have addressed this issue agree with me on that point, that the congenital defect is not reasonably foreseeable, therefore it was not proximately caused by the doctor's negligence.
Yeah, the birth was.
The birth was.
Conception and
reasonably
birth
foreseeable.
Was.
Reasonably foreseeable. Now, what developed here in this baby's heart was beyond the limits of reasonable foreseeability. And if we are to be true to establish principles of proximate causation, we must recognize, as have the courts in the same factual setting, that the doctor's error was not the proximate cause of the defective heart, and he is therefore not to be rendered liable for the cost to repair it. We've found 8 wrongful pregnancy cases besides this one in which birth defects were involved. And I must say that I have no problem with wrongful pregnancy and medical negligence.
Let's review those cases, because the first one you cite us to is from Illinois. Is that correct?
Yes.
Specifically in the Illinois case of Williams versus University of Chicago Hospitals, the first sentence that you quote to us, and I went and looked the case up because I thought it does seem like it's the same issue. But clearly, to me, at least there's a distinction, and I want to know why you think there is not. The court starts out, finally, we believe that allowing recovery of extraordinary child-rearing expenses in these circumstances would be inconsistent with the decision. To me, that sounds like what we wrestled with in Johnson, child-rearing expenses of the $300,000 was the claim in Johnson. Not the medical expenses that are directly related to the birth. Isn't there a distinction?
It's true that Williams does involve the question of whether child-rearing expenses should be permitted, just as this court faced in Johnson. And what the plaintiff is asking for here are not the total child-rearing expenses, but the medical expenses of $500.
And isn't there a difference between those two?
I don't think so.
Okay, well, We were pretty careful to craft out what child rearing expenses were in Johnson, and I think the Illinois court was too. But then let's go to the Missouri court, the failed vasectomy, when the baby was born with a defective heart condition.
Yeah.
The court held the pregnancy may result in the birthing of an abnormal child is not a foreseeable consequence. Then they talk again about the child rearing expenses, don't they? So you don't see any distinction between the actual damage, strike that because that's begging the question, the actual loss that occurred, monetary loss that occurred because of this, as opposed to future expenses for the rearing of the child. You don't see any difference between those two.
Sure, there's a difference, Your Honor, but one is part of the other. Child rearing expenses during years 1 and 2 is part of the total economic burden arising from the subsistence of a child, presumably until age 18, for medical and whatever special expenses may be incurred because of this defect. Now, I think that the clear weight of authority from the courts that have addressed these birth defect issues is that the defect was not proximately caused by the surgeon's error, and therefore the expenses involved in remedying the defect are not recoverable. I think that the but-for analysis is primitive and essentially discredited.
Counsel, let's move to a different fact pattern. Same procedure is performed on a woman not because they decided to have one or two children on all the children one, but because she has a medical condition that makes the birth of any further birth of healthy children highly improbable.
It's highly undesirable because of what she has medically in her background.
Well, it means that it's highly unlikely that any pregnancy will result in the birth of a healthy child.
She knows that going in.
And she knows that going in. The doctor knows that going in. The procedure. Same thing happens in having six.
That's a different case than we've got.
I understand. But what's the answer, given the way you're parsing this out, to that case?
Where the doctor has been put on notice of a situation that gives the parent concern.
And the reason would be that there, the force. see as though the
is much more present than what we have here.
Is present, and therefore the damages, the doctor should expect to be liable for damages that flow from
an unhealthy foreseeable result.
But don't you have the same proximate cause problem in that example as you have here? You are telling us that the doctor in this case cannot be held liable because there's no proximate cause between the defect and what he did. But you're just telling Justice Pfeiffer now that if he's informed that if the lady gets gets pregnant, in all likelihood, she will have a defective baby, the doctor still didn't cause the defect, but you say he may be liable.
He didn't cause the defect, Your Honor.
Well, why the distinction?
He's more at risk.
Why the distinction? There should be no distinction between the two if the proximate cause area that you want to argue is present. He's either never responsible for the defect, or he is if he knows about something that may happen and if he doesn't do the right thing. You're swaying from the proximate cause argument.
I'm not saying never say no, because I never say no.
Well, then in this case, we can find that his negligence was the proximate cause of the defect, because even if he wasn't on notice, I don't see how you can sway back and forth in your argument saying if he's on notice of a possible defect, and when he's not on notice of a possible defect, you have different outcomes. You should be arguing the same in each one of those cases, that he did not cause the defect, whether he knew about the possibility or not. You should be arguing the same thing. Why do you vacillate?
I'm not vacillating.
Yes, you are.
I'm not arguing the same thing. I think that there are under the
you said there are certain situations where if the doctor is on notice that this condition could happen, that his negligence then could become the proximate cause of that condition.
I think that's true. It will depend on the evidence of the condition.
Is it because reasonable foreseeability changes? Is that the reason?
It's all a matter of foreseeability. And this is the family's desire to limit the size of the family was attributable to economic concerns and not medical issues. I want to close.
So what?
I want to talk just very, very briefly about this but-for analysis.
Make that decision for economic reasons.
The but-for analysis runs head-on into proximate causation analysis. And this court is committed to the proposition that proximate causation is the way we go. We must impose liability only on persons who have acted in a way which proximately caused injury to others. We do not impose liability on the remote effects of the acts of individuals. The Sapkowski case and Jeffers versus Alexo decisions of this court cited in our brief, recent decisions, our brief, page 14, clearly commit the court to proximate causation analysis. I think the Johnson case is a good rule for Ohio. I hope it stands unimpaired. I hope that it is not nicked as a result of the unusual facts and the tragic circumstances that befall this family. It is a workable rule. It is consistent with mainstream thinking at this time in the United States, among the courts that have addressed this serious problem. Dr. Dallas did not cause this heart condition. The heart defect was not reasonably foreseeable under the circumstances in which he was operating. And the decision of the Court of Appeals should be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. O'Neill. Mr. Frantonatis, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
What is the biggest fear of a couple has in the delivery room? The fear of a defective baby, an abnormality abnormal baby. It's foreseeable. Why do we have genetic testing? Why do we have newborn screen testing in this state? Because it's foreseeable. Foreseeability is a jury question.
Don't we typically use proximate cause, though?
Absolutely.
Mr. Peritonitis.
We certainly do. And to reiterate, sperm, tubal ligation, sperm and egg don't meet. Causation is here.
It's a birth. Is a birth. Causation that causes a birth? Proximately causes a birth.
Right.
Does it proximately cause a heart defect?
Of course not. That's what trespass on the case is. It's an indirect damage.
Yeah.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.